Doing well.
Good, good.
Yeah, it's good to see you.
That's good to see you.
It's weird being in this virtual space. I was like sitting there waiting for you to start the meeting, and I was thinking like if we were meeting in person, I would see you coming and there would be like this sort of transition from you not being there to being there. And I don't know, I think they need to figure out a way to do that in virtual space. You sort of like fade in and fade out or something like that.
Well, why don't we begin? Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah.
We'll go from there.
Yeah, I think that would be a good place to start. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of branching off points that are of interest to you.
Okay.
So we'll sort of explore, hopefully.
All right.
So where to start? So I grew up here in Santa Cruz. I am one of seven children. I come from a large homeschool, Christian,
Wow.
conservative homeschool family.
Okay.
And so if you think about like sort of the stereotype in your mind when you hear that, that's sort of been my family. Less so now. We've sort of I guess is more of the so I'm the sixth out of seven, so we're
Okay.
all adults now.
Okay.
And over time we've been as more people mature and go out in the world, there's definitely less of the sheltered sort of conservative homeschool
Yeah.
vibe. But that's still that's sort of where I come from. And I would say another so we grew up Protestant,
Okay.
and I would say sort of unconventionally so. One of the unique things about our family, I think, is my parents have, for as long as I can remember, my parents have sort of questioned, I guess the church as an institution, and then a lot of the sort of theological, a lot of the big theological questions, the afterlife, heaven and hell, my dad in particular. And then, from as a result of some negative experiences with politics in the church, they sort of became quite disillusioned with the church as a, an institution. And the church, being a Protestant, that's sort of in quotes, obviously.
Which church?
Right.
There's so many of them, which you don't say if you're Orthodox or Roman Catholic.
Right. So that, we stopped going to church as a family when I was about 6 or 7 years old. My parents are self-identified Christians to this day. They believe Jesus rose from the dead and all of that.
Was there a home church or house church or anything like that in place of?
Yeah, we tried a lot of that. And yeah, so they definitely tried home church on a number of different occasions. It was always, I think I would have to talk to them, but I think the what always caused that to fall apart was, it's division, issues between individual broken humans. And I think a big part of my parents' struggle throughout their adult lives has been looking for the kind of community that will bring about healing for them and for, everyone involved. Because they have they're broken people. I mean, they had broken parents, and a sort of, you know, inherited a very skewed view of God. I think, especially my dad, that you know, he was raised Southern Baptist, and you know, was terrified of God growing up, terrified that he was gonna, you know, of this angry man in the sky who was gonna, you know, lash out at the slightest provocation, because, well, that's what his earthly father was like. And anyway, so that's, you know, this gets passed down through the generations. Sure. It impacts my life. So let's see, where do I go from there? Yeah,
you obviously,
I think
stopped homeschooling at some point, or did you homeschool all the way K through 12? Homeschooled
all the way K through 12, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then college or no college?
Yeah, so I went to UC Davis, actually. Okay. I transferred there from community college. I got my degree in mechanical engineering.
Okay.
And so I had a you know, a scientific engineering background education, and I think that was a big part in that, definitely played a role, especially like I had some really good teachers in community college for physics. Mm-hmm. And very, very influential two in particular, that I think that was sort of the learning physics from really good teachers. I think who the teacher is really matters in those contexts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that really opened me up initially, sort of intellectually. And from there, I think having inherited my dad's wrestling with these theological questions with God and all of that. Akira the Don, you know who Akira the Don is?
Yeah.
He asked on Twitter one time, what was the number one thing you learned from your dad? And I was like, oh, that's a good question. I have to think about that. And then I was like, oh, I know what it is. My dad taught me to wrestle with God.
Hmm.
And it wasn't ever anything explicit that he said. It was just that's who he was, and that's the example that he set. So, you know, I began wrestling with some of the theological questions that often come up. You know, how can a loving God send people to hell? And my parents had been, I mentioned they'd been wrestling sort of with the whole idea of the afterlife, which is, you know, the Old Testament doesn't even mention the afterlife, arguably, and the New Testament really, you know, our ideas of heaven and hell are sort of, they're not very explicit there in the New Testament. And, you know, I started watching clips here and there of N.T. Wright, and he's talking about how, you know, it's really like Bible talks about a bodily resurrection in, you know, the age to come, and that's not really what the when you think of what Christians believe, you know, what happens when you die, we seem to be confused on that. So questions like that, I began wrestling with, and there came a point where it was like, you know, I had started going to church. Me and my siblings started going to church again when I was about, you know, like a teenager, became a teenager, I'd say 13 or 14. And I actually wanted to ask you, are you familiar with Twin Lakes Church? Any of the here in Santa Cruz? Okay. No. I just thought you might be, 'cause that was the church we started going to. But I would say I didn't find the sense of belonging that every human is looking for. And, you know, that's something been struggling with my whole life. It's the same struggle my parents has. Like, where's that sense of community? And I think, you know, asking all of these questions about theology and just in my own sense of, you know, not really experiencing any sort of real relationship to God, and then not being integrated in a community. It sort of got to this point where I was like, why do I believe any of this? Like, what's holding me here? There was like a Monday morning, I woke up and I was like, something's gonna go down this week. Like, I don't, like, it wasn't an explicit thought, but it was like, it feels like something's gonna break, like something big is gonna happen. And like, sure enough, by that Friday morning, I was in my electric circuits lab. And usually I would stay like Friday afternoon to work on homework and at school and free up time for the weekend. And I just like couldn't do, like, as soon as my lab was over, I just went straight to my car and I drove home and I drove into my driveway, and then it was like, boom. And like, I didn't believe any of it anymore. And that was like that moment was very terrifying for me. It's like, you know, my whole world up to that point had been rooted in the Christian belief system that I had been raised in. All of my relationships in my life were, for the most part, you know, that was a big part of it. And so there's just this terrifying sense of like everything I've been standing on just is crumbling beneath me. And I FaceTimed my brother who's away at my younger brother who was away at school up in Seattle, and you know, I was just in tears, like, what's happening to me? Mm-hmm. And it turns out he had been going through something similar. Hmm. And just didn't feel like he was in a place comfortably to share it.
Yeah.
So I was unaware of that.
Yeah.
And so I have two brothers and four sisters, and all three of us boys have gone through a similar sort of deconstructive process at this point. And, you know, my older brother went through that before me. So it was less of a shock when I was sort of, you know, expressing this to my parents, that it was something that they had already experienced. That initial moment was like, I had never experienced that sort of a profound disillusion of everything I thought I knew. The whole propositional framework. And I still had the notion of like God at that point, but just like, I don't know, like the Jesus rising from the dead was, yeah, I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Why do I believe this anymore? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in the following weeks after that, though, it was like I would say those were up to that point in my life, some of the most free, like the freest weeks of my life. Mm-hmm. There was just, it was like I had been born again, but like, rather than being converted, I had been deconverted. And I'm like, this doesn't make sense to any of the stories I've been told my whole life. It's like, I've been waiting for this experience, like this sort of, you know, revelation of something beyond what I've been used to, the little box that I've been stuck in. Mm-hmm. And I was always looking for that as like, you know, because I'd hear stories of Christians who went through this profound, whether it's a conversion experience or some sort of revelation experience. And that it felt sort of like that happened to me. It's like I experienced that opening between the self and the world that John Vervaeke talks about, that reciprocal opening. As a result of like breaking free of that you know, what was in many ways a sort of a cage for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, and it was a useful, I would say, generative scaffold insofar that it gave me a thing to grow in, mm-hmm, but like mm-hmm. it, you know, at some point it's like I had to break free of that.
Mm-hmm.
So then I, from there, got into Sam Harris, sort of the new atheist crowd. I was sort of wrapped up in that until Jordan Peterson came on the scene. And so, you know, you've talked to many young men who have similar stories. But yeah, I have basically the same story of, I first heard Jordan Peterson on Sam Harris's podcast, when they did those first two conversations. And I was like, this guy, the first one, I was like, this guy is crazy with his, you know, pragmatic notion of truth. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And then little by little, it's like, okay, this is interesting though. Like, this is, I got to think about this.
Yeah.
And, I started listening to his biblical series, and that was like, let's see, when was that? That was January of 2018, I think, when I started listening to those. And it was just like, you know how he is, how he speaks, and it's all over the place, and you're like, where is this guy going? And then somehow it's like he brings it all together. And you know, for the first two or three episodes, it was like, where is this going? Like, this is just like, something wasn't clicking for me. And then suddenly it like clicked. And it was like this, I don't know. I started just being able to see things in a different way as a result of having sort of internalized Jordan Peterson's way of perceiving the world and talking about the world and all of that. And so then little by little Christianity started to take on this new light for me. And I was like, oh, you know, I can see it through like this, you know, as this sort of mythological, structure, that's sort of at the bottom of our civilization. And there's a very profound story there that like speaks to the perennial patterns of humanity. And then Peterson as a person, I think in many ways was that, you know, father figure that mm-hmm. I had been longing for.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so that's I don't deny that that's a, you know, big part of what drew me to him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was like, you know, this sense of a call to, you know, to make something of my life and to take it seriously. And it was like this big, you know, sobering time of my life. And it's interesting. I recently read Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov, mm-hmm. and it was a similar effect. It's like a totally different, mm-hmm. you know, it's a novel, it's a work of literature, but it was like that same sobering effect. Mm-hmm. And for me, it makes sense. Like, Peterson's been very heavily influenced by Dostoevsky. There's like a similar spirit I get from both of them. It's like, mm-hmm. it's like, I don't know quite how to describe it, but it's just like this very, there's like, you know, these piercing eyes, and it's just like very sobering to look into those eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just sort of like the metaphor that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
From Peterson, I would say, that took me into John. I stumbled across John Vervaeke's mm-hmm. work. I went through his whole Awakening from the Meaning Crisis.
Yeah.
And he, and that was, you know, I've been thinking sort of wrestling with the church, again in quotes,
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
I guess in this, it, because it's so it's been such a part of my parents' struggle, is trying to find that, you know, where's the body of Christ? Like, what is that supposed to look like? What is that supposed to be? I think I've been sort of at a distance wrapped up in their struggle, but also for my own, like it's my own struggle as well. And so, I've been looking at sort of the problems I have with the church as I've experienced it within Protestantism, mm-hmm. and realizing a lot through John Vervaeke's Awakening from the Meaning Crisis that what I was attributing to Christianity or Protestantism is actually just one instance of a bigger cultural, meaning crisis. So I don't think it's fair to put the blame on Christianity or on Protestantism or in any one denomination. I think it's all interconnected in this meaning crisis. And that was sort of one of the big revelations I had, was like, oh, everyone, this isn't just Christianity that, we're all trying to find that, what is it, what does true community look like? What is that supposed to be? And then the other thing I would say from John Vervaeke is like, he helped integrate sort of my more academic pursuits in engineering. And then, I, via Peterson, got very interested in psychology and philosophy. And then Vervaeke comes along with cognitive science. And I have this interest in artificial intelligence and artificial life. So he's sort of, Vervaeke's integrated a lot of things for me in very like profound ways. And then his Dialogos project, which is, just sitting down and having conversations with people. It's so cool. I've thought about how he talks about in this idea of internalizing the sage. And I think, okay, who is the sage? What is the sage? Because we seem to have like a notion of like the sage is like this, archetypal wise man maybe. And I've been noticing like, I sort of piece together who that person is through the men I encounter in my life in particular. And I'm noticing like who are the men that I look up to? And it's like, oh, it's Jordan Peterson, it's John Vervaeke, it's these people that Jordan Hall, Paul Vanderclay, Jonathan Pageau, Guy Sengstock. It's all these people who are having these conversations. And the really cool thing about that I've noticed is that it's not just I'm seeing these individuals isolated from one another and internalizing them as sort of like separate entities. It's like they're talking to each other, and like you're talking to all of these people in these different combinations.
Yeah.
And then that does something to, in the way I've internalized all of these different people. It's, I get to experience that dialogue take place within myself.
Yeah.
And I just think that's so cool. So it's like been this profound journey just to be a passive observer up till just recently.
Yeah.
And now it's like, okay, I want to start taking the courageous steps of actually being a participant in some of these dialogues. So hence my time reaching out to you and talking.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Well, that's helpful. That's really helpful. Shoot, you're in Santa Cruz. So is I saw a few others. That's been interesting. How, you know, because part of what, and I think this is also part of Verveke's vision, but I haven't heard it. I haven't seen him do as much of the organizing as, let's say, you know, we've done with Bridges of Meaning and the meetups. You know, there's a, it's a weird thing. Because on one hand, you know, Peugeot, when Peugeot said, well, you know, when you look at people on YouTube, you're watching beings of light. And when Peugeot said that, a light went on for me. It's like, oh, yeah, well, there's this weird trick that we do, like what you noticed when, you know, boop, here I am in a Zoom room and you and I are here in a Zoom room and we're talking over this machine. And there's enough here that it sort of gives us the sense that we're speaking face to face, but there are gaps in it that we know we're not. And there's a degree of unreality that is happening here. So, because it's one thing to encounter the sage and to have conversations with the beings of light. It's another, I think all of that moves us to want to, you know, basically embody the positive, the attractive, honorable, desirable qualities that we see, you know, Rene Girard, his mimetic theory of desire. You know, we begin to desire, part of our desire is this mimicry, this mimetic behavior. And, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot. That's deep in terms of who we are and what we do. And so, you know, that obviously is a big deal with fathers that, I mean, our fathers, and I just, my sermon last week, our fathers are our first neighbors, our fathers and mothers, and they're our most God-like neighbors in that they create us. And they don't just, you know, in the case of a biological parent who is also the parent that raises us, they don't just produce us in terms of our genetic material and carry through the genetic material of their ancestors, but they also, so much of us is this this culture being, and we, you know, I was thinking, you know, as a pastor, you talk to people who are getting married and wrestling with their relationships in marriage, or having children and wrestling with their being as parents, and coming to terms with the fact that they inherited a first draft that their conscious self didn't sort of evaluate. It's just all built into you. And so I love your story and how you related it, this first draft that, you know, and your parents didn't even know consciously they were bestowing that on you too. And of course, being one of seven siblings, you also realize, because I have five children, that all of you have the same genetic parents, sort of had the same, you know, the same formative parents that raised you, but you know, you're towards at the end, and each of those first children began to re-edit your parents' parenting drafts so that by the time they got to you, you had slightly different parents than your older siblings had.
Oh yeah.
but it's also, you know, it also occurred to me when you were telling your story how, so we homeschooled our children as well, not all the way through 12th grade. So our oldest son very much wanted to play basketball. And so that sort of led him into the school system. And then my second son was quite tall. He was tall like I am. And he followed sort of in his brother's footsteps. So not only were my wife and myself imprinting our children, but then the oldest sibling starts to imprint the children too. And you talked about that in terms of the deconstructive experience that you had. So, and now of course, then, you know, I also, in the sermon I preached last week, I brought up John Van Donk's father, his biological father, was not a great father, and in many ways abandoned the family. His biological father was in the Netherlands during the Second World War, a young man, and worked for the Nazis. And, you know, those are the Dutch after the war told all of these stories about how their ancestors resisted the Nazis and hid Jews, but John has the opposite story, and it's a shameful story. And so John went through his life with some resentment and, you know, about fatherhood, only later on to realize that he in fact had been fathered by many others along the way. So, you know, all, saying all of that to sort of, you know, sort of come around your story as your, you know, the deep impact, obviously, of your parents, and the people don't sufficiently realize sort of the anti-institutional element in homeschooling. Because it's, you know, so often you read in the secular media all of this suspicion and alarm at homeschooling. You know, these homeschoolers are, you know, how dare they educate their own children? And then to listen to like Brett and Heather Weinstein, or Heather Hying and Brett Weinstein sort of become neo-traditionalists with the family. And, but so it's not surprising that the suspicion of institutions that your parents exhibited in the choice to homeschool all of you also was there in terms of the church.
Mm.
And I love what you said about noticing that, well, it isn't just church people who are looking for the perfect church. We're all looking for that community. And in a sense, every parent tries their hand at creating it with a family and fails. Mm. And then every friend group, because you sort of begin with the family as your friend group, and especially if you're homeschooled, I mean, that really creates tight bonds between the sibling, especially if the parents are doing a good job. And you all, you know, one of the things, it's not uncommon to hear other parents complain about how their children don't get along. My children get along quite well together. It doesn't mean they don't have, you know, favorites or get sideways with each other, but for the most part, the experience of homeschooling taught them how to, you know, have differences and mend fences and look to each other and trust each other in a deep way. So just last weekend, we had all of the kids together. We were visiting my son in Cayucos down the coast. And so my youngest son goes to UC Santa Cruz. And so he's living in Santa Cruz right now. And so he drove down. So now I love your story, and there's so much I can relate to it. And now, especially at your age, you know, you've been imprinted by your parents, and that was the first draft. And so now you're trying other drafts. And so, you know, now via YouTube, you're not limited to your college professors or your local pastor, or, and in a sense, you can sort of look at these others and try them out, but the same, that's going to work through, because you're going to, at some point, probably want to pursue not only, you know, looking at the sages and talking to the sages, but embodying the sage and embody the father, and, you know, probably, you know, find a spouse and create a family. And so every church planter I know, in their church planting, they pursue exactly what you've been talking about, because they've been involved in churches and they say, but I'd like to try my hand at doing it right. And like every parent starts a family, both hopefully experiences a degree of success and then a degree of, oh, I was fathered. I tried my hand at fathering, and maybe I achieved some of those things that I felt my father didn't do well, but I also found myself repeating some of the things my father didn't do well. And I found some things recognizing that my father did well that didn't arise to my conscious layer. And that's why I very intentionally use that first draft language, because when people enter into a relationship, a significant romantic, intimate relationship, suddenly, because the other person is looking back and saying, why did you do that? And you say, I don't know. So it's, you know, at your stage in life, you're doing what you need to do in terms of, and it's so amazing that nobody sat us down and told us this. Maybe someone did, but, you know, I'm excited that Peterson's going to look at the book of Proverbs, and it makes deep sense in terms of the Peterson wave, because the book of Proverbs is all about, this is what young men need to know. And so what you're doing in terms of, you know, watching me or Peugeot or Vervaeke and Peterson, you're working through those issues and you're gathering wisdom and you're accumulating it. And just like as this infant and toddler and grade schooler and high schooler and college, you didn't, especially as in the younger years, you didn't recognize you were absorbing from your parents and filtering as you absorbed. And all of that was getting built into you. I mean, you're doing the same thing now, and it's exactly right. And it's the right time in your life to do it. And, you know, and your longings are leading you in the right direction and saying, where can I find that community that fleshes me out, and the role how can I become a part of a principality, as it were, as this, because we human beings are very strange. We're not whole until we find ourselves in, as the New Testament calls, a body. You're in the body of Christ. And so, I mean, even the language, Christ is the principality and we are members. And the Apostle Paul says, you know, we're not members like at Costco, where we're just sort of numbers, where you long to be in a body where the uniqueness that has been built into you by your story and by your genetics and by everything that you are now suddenly finds fulfillment and place and manifestation in that larger, I mean, that's what you're longing for with community. Mm-hmm. And your longing is really a wonderful thing in that, well, it's hard because it's an unfulfilled thing, but it drives you into saying, can we make this community better? Can we perfect it? Can we improve it? And you might not even know all of the components that are in this idealized community that you're longing for and looking for. You know, if I asked you to write them down, you could give me kind of a list, but it's much more intuitive than that, because you come up against something and say, this, not that, I think.
Yeah.
So I've rambled on long enough, but I just wanted to say all that because in listening to your story, you're doing the right thing. And I want to encourage you to keep doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, there's a lot of things as you were talking that I thought I could pick up on. I think one of them is, noticing division within my own family, much of which has come with the fact that, the three of us boys have gone through this whole deconstructive process, and everyone has their own journey. And everyone has a very complex journey that they're on. And, but those journeys take you in different places. And then it's like, you start speaking a different language in some sense along the way. And then like, I have a harder time speaking to members of my family because there's just a barrier that we're not using the same grammar. We don't quite have the same operating system anymore that we're, that we're operating from. And so that's been a big part of my inquiry into what is it that really matters. Because I can search and search and search and, come up with all of these cool ideas and absorb all of these cool ideas, but it's like, okay, so what's really important here? And it's, this is why I think, I keep re-realizing the importance of John's whole Dialogos project. Is like, we're learning, we have to learn how to dialogue with people who might not speak the same language that we do. We have to learn how to, to translate, we have to learn how to speak each other's languages. And I think there's something there about speaking, a question in my mind is like, what is the fundamental human language? And can we all learn to speak that? And, we could probably argue about what that is for forever. But I think I wanted to get into the sort of what I've been noticing is the main divide, at least for myself, between myself and some of members of my family or members of my Christian community who I care deeply for. And I think that divide is like, I've come to a place where it's like, I can participate in the Christian story, like the passion story in particular. It's like, that's, I've noticed on days where it seems like, I don't know where I am, I'm lost and I'm confused, I start coming back to that story. It's like that sort of comes back online as my default. And there's something there and I can participate in it. But if you were to ask me, did Jesus come back to life? The historical Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
If I'm in, historical scientific mindset, yeah, I'm like,
yeah,
no, that's probably not. No.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that's the, like, if you take that away, you're no longer a Christian for most Christians. It's like, that's what it means to be a Christian, is you believe the resurrection of Jesus Christ actually happened in history.
Right.
And there's something about that, and I haven't quite figured this out, so it'd be interesting to explore here and see what you think of this. Is, for me, it seems like so much of the significance of Christianity to me has been realized for me only in letting go of my grip on the historical, you know, the you know, this literally happened.
Yeah.
And it's, and what I see is that the sort of cosmic universal aspect of Christianity is lost in this emphasis on, like, the whole apologetics movement. I get so frustrated with, because it's like, oh no, science is undermining, you know, our, you know, young people are leaving the church because science. And so, well, let's use science to show that this stuff actually really did happen. And to me, that's completely missing the whole point. Mm-hmm. And you're missing, like, I listen to someone like Jonathan Pageau talk about Christianity, and it's just like, yes, like, you're like, there's a, it's like, it's the pattern is, you see it everywhere. Like, he talks about the pattern, and there's something that is missed when you are fixated on the history of Christianity as, I'm seeing this as sort of like the dividing point, like the sticking point, where it's like, I'm not interested in persuading someone out of this or that belief. Like, I don't think that's actually what's important. But in my ability to communicate, it seems like that is often like the finality of this belief system having, you know, and the historical literalism of that belief system, that seems to be like this huge sticking point. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I'm noticing that the sort of like mythological appreciation I have for mm-hmm. Christianity in like the huge cosmic sense of it, if it's, you know, it has the same pattern that reality to, like, it's illustrating that pattern. I'm noticing that part of the pattern is the instantiation in history. And I'm trying to reconcile these things. I don't know if that's clear.
That, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay, so.
So fix it. Well, think about, let's start here. Let's start at the premise of cognitive science. I have to be quick here because we only have an hour. But start at the premise of cognitive science, that the world is so huge at any given moment. You know, I'm sitting here in the corner of my office, and when people come to the meetup, they sometimes say, can I see where you do your videos? So sure, come on in. It's a messy office that if I'm over there and I do Zoom in that computer, it's, everybody's like, your office is a mess. And you make Jordan Peterson videos? Yes, I do. Life is so huge. The world is so huge. At any given moment, in order to reduce just what is in this little, how big is my office? 10 by 4, 10 by 12, something like that. This little 10 by 12 office that I have with no see-through windows. To reduce this to math, let's say, there's not enough time in my life to reduce this whole room to math at every level that's here, because this office and the books and the material and everything that's in this little messy 10 by 12 room is near infinite in terms mm-hmm. of reducing it, even just, let's say, to mathematical description, leaving alone being and meaning and all of that. It's just mm-hmm. way too much. And so what we do, and this is just flat out amazing, what we do as human beings is actually find ways to manage this through just ways to management and interact with it. I mean, it's just an astounding thing that we can do. Well, how do we do it? We do it by taking certain things, and this is sort of Vervaekian relevance realization. We take certain things and we talk about the whole in that certain things. For example, even just that I use the word office, just flood your mind with is just like a string that's connected to this entire universe of ideas about who I am and what I do and what's in this and what this room is for. And I mean, just that one little word office, it's just a miracle what that word, little word is. And that, and you and I are just in this, in the process of this little hour long conversation, we've managed this at a level which is just absolutely phenomenal. Okay. So let's think about an intimate relationship between two people. And let's think about a marriage, let's say. And then let's think about, yeah, I'm going to use a little word that's going to just fill up the universe, adultery. And what is adultery? Well, that's when somebody sleeps with, what do you mean sleep? It's not sleeping at all. It's in fact that they're not sleeping that people have a problem. Someone sleeps with another. Okay, why do we use that word adultery? What has been adulterated by that one little act? And then as a pastor, it's not uncommon to get into conversations and people will say, well, I didn't have sex with that woman, Monica Lewinsky. Well, okay. Well, what happened between you and Monica Lewinsky? What happened between you? Well, it was just an emotional affair. Well, that's worse. Well, why? And so basically what I'm getting at is that everything comes down to tiny things. And so what happens, let's say, in an affair, in an adulterous affair, is that this act, this something that, and it is significant that whether they didn't or did have sex, that's important. Why is it important? And if you ponder that, you begin to recognize that the layers that unfold and the levels of the layers and all of this, there's something, and that's why we use reality in very material senses. It's when something is true at every level that it's really true and it's really important. And it's really durable. And again, we don't know all of this very well, but part of us does. And that's why if you are in an intimate relationship with someone else and they come to you or somehow you find out this person did that, they touched them in a certain way with certain body parts, all that meaning just explodes and transforms the world. Well, that's why the resurrection plays the role that it does in Christianity, because stuff is connected to that. And you're exactly right when you say, well, I see bunches of Christians saying, I believe in the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. But then you look at the rest of their life and it's like, well, if you really do, it doesn't seem to matter. Because when it comes to the way you're living the rest of your life, it all seems to be the same. And because when you think about, and this is equally true of deciding, I can't believe it happens. That is also connected to a world of things that fans out from there. Now, we have to be really careful with this because we should take Jordan Peterson's admonition to heart about religion that, you know, what you say but you believe in, you don't believe in, yeah, that's important, but it's not the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's way more going on than that. And you know that by virtue of the way that this tiny little incident happens, because there are many, many people throughout history who have basically said, well, I'm sure resurrection, no problem. And it doesn't change their life. And there are other people that say, oh, definitely resurrection. It doesn't make any difference in their life. And so when you notice and listen to Jonathan Peugeot and see the mythology and the symbolism and the system and all the things that this has wrought, in a sense, you're looking at the other end of it and saying, wow. And those things are connected. And so the whole thing that we desire is this whole thing connected.
Mm-hmm.
Because the resurrection doesn't just mean a man came back to life. We got that with Lazarus. We got that with this, you know, Jesus is walking into town, there's a funeral procession, and there's a widow, and she's crying because she's lost her son. That's a really big deal in that culture, because her son was her social security, her retirement, or, you know, that was, and Jesus stops the procession and raises the dude, and is like, bang. But the resurrection, and this is C.S. Lewis's point about the resurrection, everyone, and he wrote about this in his book, Miracles, everybody focuses like on those first few minutes of the resurrection. And Lewis says, that's not what energized the Christian church to do what they did. It was the fact that just like an adulterous spouse going and saying, yeah, I slept with that person. Boosh. C.S. Lewis says that the resurrection starts to make this world that is colonized and conquered by death, that starts to change this world. And that starts to change how people act. And when you look at Christianity in all of its manifest ways and symbolism, like Peugeot is so effective at laying out, it's the word he always uses, you're looking at that end of it. Mm-hmm. And the assertion of Christianity is that just like, you know, if, you know, I can remember the first time I saw my wife. I can almost describe what she was wearing. And it was like, bang, that moment started something. And now, you know, 32 years of marriage, 5 children, some really beautiful, wonderful things, some really hard, painful things. Every marriage is full of this stuff. But it starts someplace. And that's what Christianity says about the resurrection. And so I don't, you know, and you're right about apologetics, because whereas, and I don't want to be unkind to apologists in this or unfair to them, because many good apologists I know understand the limitations of what they do. I mean, if they can argue and say, yeah, I can convince you that the resurrection happened, that doesn't make you a Christian.
Hmm.
And I would also say that in a weird way, there are plenty of Christians out there running around who don't believe in the resurrection. On both sides of it, they say they do or they say they don't. I mean, it's, and that's where Jordan Peterson's point has to be taken into account. And part of my, and I really have to land the plane here because I got somebody else now waiting for me. Part of what, and it's for that reason why, you know, I encourage people to keep with to keep being honest with themselves about these kinds of things. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people will, okay, I want to rush a verbal profession out of you that says, I believe Jesus walked out of that grave. I don't think that's terribly productive, because you, like me, the noisy member of our consciousness Congress is by no means all the only delegate in that assembly. So, I think actually most Christians I deeply value, and most of what they've been really able to offer me is because they've deconstructed and reconstructed. Because that deconstruction and reconstruction is, again, you're part of a principality, you're part of this cohort, you're part of this group, and you're working through the issues. And so the history of Christianity has been personal deconstructions and reconstructions all the way through. That's what we find with Saul to Paul. You know, he's a Pharisee.
And you could argue that that's what is exemplified in Christ. It's the dying and resurrecting individual.
Which is Jordan Peterson's big thing about the resurrection. He's saying, well, did it happen? Almost certainly not. Sam Harris backs him into a corner. But then Jordan Peterson says, but look at what it's done for us, whether or not you believe it. That's power. And that's the power of a real thing. And a real thing that isn't just a physical thing, but a physical thing that is tied all the way out through the culture net and through all of this stuff that that we live in the midst of and care so much about. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, well, I feel like we just got started on something. Yes. I hope we can do this again soon.
I hope we can.
I have a lot more to say based on what I just heard. So,
well, are you in the Discord? The Bridges of Meaning Discord?
I don't think so.
Oh, you'll want to get into there.
Okay.
and I don't know if this is the kind of video you think, I can send this to you, and if you want to look at it before I share it, or if you don't want me to share it all, that's fine. I don't know what you think.
No, I'm perfectly happy with you sharing this. Yeah.
Okay. Because I mean, part of the reason I started sharing these videos is because you're not alone in working through these issues, and you shouldn't be. And that's good news, because there's lots of conversation partners out there who, you know, they've come at it from different places, and, you know, they're doing the work as you are. So that's sort of what Bridges of Meaning Discord is about. And so, I do. I'll have to see if I do it this Friday. I do question and answer every Friday morning, 10 a.m. California time. So, and this is the kind of thing that a lot of those folks like to talk about.
Okay, great.
And if you can ever get to Sacramento for one of our local meetups, I mean, then we can talk more. That's cool too.
Yeah, I should do that sometime.
So, I can send you a link to our own little Discord server for our group, and that will keep you up to speed on, actually, we've got another meeting coming up this Sunday, 4 p.m. here at Living Stones. So if you want to make the trip, you know, you can come by then too. I'm a lot easier to get in touch with in person than on the internet. The line of people who want to talk to me on the internet is long. In Sacramento, it's a lot shorter. So, which is a good thing. So,
all right. That's good to know.
So I got to go, because the other guy's sitting in the waiting room.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul. This has been wonderful. I hope to do it again soon.
All right. Thanks, Joe. Take care. Bye-bye.